was really the year of the women. And I think it's connected to the Me Too movement, the Time's Up movement. It's connected to having someone like Donald Trump in the White House. I mean, all of it started with the Women's March.
How do you keep it energized?
It was energized from 2016.
I'm Bonnie Urbay. Welcome to The Contrary. This week, we welcome political activist Karine Jean-Pierre. She currently serves as the senior advisor and national spokeswoman for MoveOn.org, as well as a frequent contributor on MSNBC. She was previously the deputy campaign manager for Barack Obama and a part of his administration. Thank you for joining us,
Karine. Thank you so much for having me, Bonnie. Such an honor. So thank you.
It's reciprocal. Thank you.
Thank you.
So what got you into politics? You're the daughter of immigrants from New York City. How did you get connected at the presidential level?
Oh, my goodness. That's such I don't even know if it's a loaded question or a long story, but it's something. Daughter of immigrants, as you just mentioned, but both my parents are from Haiti, Haitian immigrants. I'm an immigrant actually myself. I was born in Martinique and came here with my parents when I was just a toddler. And when growing up in that household, you're told, and I think a lot of immigrants who may be watching will feel this way too. You're told you're going to be a doctor, a lawyer, or an engineer. And I grew up in New York, and that was the thinking when I was in my young years. And I thought, and I had picked doctor. I was like, oh, I'm going to be a doctor. That's what my parents want me to do. That's the right thing to do. Went through college, pre-med, in college, and after college, I thought to myself, that's not what I want to do, when I was applying to medical school and trying to figure it all out. And I thought, this is not it. Clearly this path isn't working for me. This is not what I want to do. My parents were very disappointed, and they didn't really understand, like, what was I going to do next? I promised them that I would go back to school. I would figure it out. And I did. I spent about a year or two working for a non-for-profit, figuring it all out, like I said. And
in
then,
the health area?
No, not at all. I actually ended up going into environmental. So environmental policy, worked for a non-for-profit that focused on kind of environmental justice and education, all of it lumped in. I worked on a project with young girls who are living in underserved communities and really bringing in science. There was a study that showed that when young girls reach, I think, 12 years old, seventh grade, they lose interest in math and science. So this program, using the environment, hopefully the hope was to get them interested or keep them interested in science. So I did that type of work for about a year. And then I applied to Columbia University, SIPA, School of International Public Affairs. Went there and I thought I would get a master's in public administration, which I did, but I was introduced to politics in different ways. David Dinkins, who is a professor still there.
Former New York City
mayor, first African-American mayor of New York City, was there. I had a great, wonderful mentor as well in Professor Esther Fuchs, who was at Barnard and also Columbia, really wonderful mentor. And like I mentioned, David Dinkins. And they introduced me into the world of politics. And they encouraged me to, if you really want to make a difference, if there's another way you can make a difference, which is going into public policy. And so, and at that point, just to age myself, in 2001 is when I went to Columbia to start my first year of this program. Mayor Michael Bloomberg, was running for mayor, and so Esther Fuchs was a senior advisor to him. So that's how I, you know, there was a lot of mayoral politics going on, just a lot of stuff. It was 9/11 had happened the first week that I started, so there was it was really prominent in my life at the time, and so I thought about it. And something else happened in my last year of Columbia in this program is I went to Haiti for the first time. I had never been to Haiti, and so I was kind of inspired to really wanting to go back to America after that trip, a place that I call home. I'm a citizen, clearly. Went to school here, my family's here, and I wanted to really figure out how I can make a difference for people who were underserved, who were marginalized.
The earthquake victims.
Yeah. Yeah, and so I wanted to figure out how to do that, and so I did. I went into politics. I did local politics, New York City Council, ran my first campaign, New York City Council, for a council member that I was working with at the time. Then I went to work for Walmart Watch. I wanted to do national politics, so came to D.C. for the first time in like 2005, worked for Walmart Watch. Then in 2007, I moved to North Carolina, Chapel Hill, went to work for John Edwards for his presidential. So then it kind of, you know, did that's kind of the track, and then ended up in the Obama campaign for the general election in 2008, and then in the Obama White House. I've been a very lucky person, but it's been through hard work and just focus and really determination and wanting to do good and wanting to do better and wanting to be an activist.
And now MoveOn.org.
And now MoveOn.org.
What are you working on?
So we're working on so many things, I have to tell you. So we have more than 5 million members of MoveOn. MoveOn's been around for about 20 years.
That's as big as the NRA.
Oof, well, yeah. And their troubles. Yeah. Yes, not to compare ourselves to the NRA, but yes, we are a massive organization, been around for 20 years. A progressive, independent progressive organization is the largest one in the country. And since 2016, November 2016, the election of Donald Trump, our members have been incredibly engaged. They've been all in, very focused, and we have been able to help with that energy to push forth really some great victories, I think, we feel. And it all, Women's March was a great pivotal point as well with the energy there. And one of the first organic, I would say, protests that happened was the Muslim ban, the first Muslim ban, and people showed up at the airport and wanting to really, hundreds of people showed up protesting and really wanted to help folks who were coming in and just sending a message to the administration. So helping to kind of garner that energy, and then with the special elections that came after that, off-year elections in 2017, the Alabama Senate race that happened, that special election, our members have been all in, really engaged, volunteering, and getting out there, getting people to vote. And it led up to this big win for midterm elections, as we all know, in November 6th, where it was historical in many ways.
Well, tell me exactly, so you're really an organization of community organizers,
yes,
right?
Community organizers, members on the ground trying to get the word out, knocking on doors. We have a text program where people were doing peer-to-peer text messages where we reached more tens and tens of millions of people, getting them to go out there and volunteer. We have an email list that we were able to raise millions of dollars, well, over $1 million for someone like Stacey Abrams, who ran a very powerful, strong race in Georgia, and helped like someone like Lucy McBath win, who took back who won in a very red congressional district, a district that belonged to years ago to Newt Gingrich. So wins like that, we endorsed more than 200 candidates across the country. 100 of them were House members, 100 of them were down ballot members, and was able to raise over $5 million for House members directly, candidates, for example. So we were able to be a powerhouse financially, getting those small dollar donations to help candidates, getting our members to go out there and volunteer and call people and text people and remind them of the importance of this election. And so that's one of the things that we just came out of doing recently.
A number of people have been questioning the strength of the Me Too movement. Is it fading?
Oh, absolutely not.
How can you measure that?
So I think one way to measure that is just looking, as I was talking about this midterm election, the amount of women that got elected. It was a pink wave, if you will, right? Women who we have now a historic number of women that are coming into Congress. I think there is we wouldn't have done so well in this midterm election if it wasn't for women. women of color, black women who came out, even in these districts. It was suburban women that crossed over, who were Republican, that crossed over and voted for Democrats. So you saw the power of the woman. And also when we had the Kavanaugh confirmation, when we lost that fight, I remember being out there in front of the SCOTUS building, speaking to the women that are out there or the people who are out there, and they were upset. They were crying the day, that Saturday, the day that he actually got confirmed, but they were upset, but they were energized and they were ready to go. And so it's not a, you know, it's a measurement that I look at that I think, yeah, I think that matters. I think it wouldn't have, it was really the year of the women this year. And I think it's connected to the Me Too movement, the Time's Up movement. It's connected to having someone like Donald Trump in the White House. I mean, all of it started with the Women's March that, you know, hundreds of thousands of women came out just right here in Washington, D.C., and it continued. And
How do you keep it energized until 2020?
So, you know, it's really interesting because it was energized from 2016 all the way to 2018. So when people say to me, well, how do you keep the energy going? It was going organically on its
is
own
it
for 2 years.
Is it because of Donald Trump?
It is. It really is. Donald Trump has really tapped into something really horrific, really, the things that he's done like I said, marginalized communities, vulnerable communities, women, people of color, you name it, LGBTQ communities, that folks are saying, no way. And the corruptness of it as well is really just,
but
it's just unreal. 40%. He does.
Support. President Nixon.
Yeah.
When he left because of Watergate, he had 27% support.
And I wish I could explain that. You're right, Bonnie. You're absolutely right. He has 80 to 90% support of Republicans leading into the midterms. And it's unreal. And a lot of it is because while he's saying a lot of terrible rhetoric and doing bad things, there are things that that base really loves that he's doing. The deregulation, the putting Kavanaugh on the bench, having actually two SCOTUS picks, and the tax cuts for the wealthy. Those are things that his base really love. But he's also hurting a lot of people in his base, but they're blindly loyal. I mean, the farmers with this trade war, he's hurting people in Iowa and North Dakota and Ohio who supported him.
And we're still supporting him.
We're still supporting him. That I cannot explain the blind loyalty, but I can explain that the energy is still there and it will continue. There were two other things that really, I think, played into the energy that we saw the last 2 years was the families being separated at the border, children being separated from their parents. We had the Families Belong Together rally right here in D.C. where, you know, tens of thousands of people showed up and it was 96 degree weather. And that, after that, speaking of women, women started sprinting away from him. The numbers, he really went south with the support of women. And that we saw some of his lowest approval ratings. It was like at 36, 37% at that point. So there are things like that where people have really shunned him and said, no way, this is not the type of country we want to be. Another example as well.
Do you, as a woman of color, feel like prejudice has gotten worse?
So I think it was...
I mean, personally. Have you encountered it?
You know, it's one of those things, I think when you're a person of color, when you're a black woman, you experience it every day. It doesn't go away. It's as simple as walking into, you know, people tell their story, walking into a store and people look at you and wonder, do you belong in the store, right? It's as simple as a cab not wanting to pull over and because you're a person of color or a black woman or a black man. It happens every day. I think the difference that we're seeing now is it's been around, and I want to be careful because I don't want to blame Donald Trump for racism. It's been around way before he's been around. I think that what he has done is he has made it blatantly overt, like people are just overt about it in a way that I have never seen before. We saw candidates in this last election who were proud to be white supremacist, white nationalist, talking about purging and that we need a white power, white America. I mean, this is what we were hearing from some candidates, and they were in the Republican Party. I mean, I want to be clear, the Republican Party did denounce denounce these candidates, but we saw them. We saw them across the country, and we had never seen that before, or hadn't seen it in a very long time. So, I mean, it's really you look at what's going on, and you're thinking, wow, he's taking us back to like some Jim Crow era, which is really sad and scary for many people.
Do you suffer more, or I should say, are you the target of? Because I don't think you allow yourself to suffer, you fight back.
Oh, I fight back at every turn.
But are you targeted more for race bias or gender bias? So, which is worse?
I get the race stuff very, you know, it's easy for folks to, you know, I do a hit on TV or they see me speaking in front of the SCOTUS building and Supreme Court Justice building because of Justice Kavanaugh, or in front of Capitol building, and it's race. They go to race automatically, and then gender. So it's that's kind of the hatred that I get.
Did you get it as much when you were working in the Obama White House?
Not at all. Not at all. But I also wasn't as public, to be fair. It is now the past 2-3 years that I am very public. I'm one of the voices of Move On, and I'm out there, you know, all the time speaking up. And there's a real fight that's being had, that we're having right now. And I feel like we can't be silent. I can't be silent.
Do you get death threats?
Well, no, not really. I mean, I got about 2 years ago, there was a threat, No, it's mostly racist, you know, sexist, misogynistic stuff that I get. But
the internet's the Wild West.
It's the Wild Wild West. Yeah, a lot of hatred. Yeah.
Do you ever think that part of Trump's success was whites feeling threatened by a black president?
I do. So I worked in the Obama administration, as you mentioned, the first 2 years. I worked in his first election in 2008 and his reelection. And I've talked about this on TV before, and I've said basically that when he got elected, I think people thought we were in a post-racial America, and we were not. I think what we learned is that racism was very much real and still very much around. And the obstruction that he saw, the horrible racist rhetoric of having a black family in the White House was very clear, that you felt the hate and you saw the hate. And I think what ended up happening is...
And yet he was reelected.
He was reelected, yes, he was. And I think because that speaks to the type of candidate and the type of person he is and the type of message that he had for this country. And I think we had the best candidate. Donald Trump touched on something that was happening in 2011, which was the birtherism. And that was his first entree into politics, right, into the political arena. And Donald Trump became, I like to say, the grand wizard of birtherism, because he took that mantle and was a bullhorn for it, and questioned then President Obama's birth. Was he born here? Is he even American?
And he ran as anti-immigrant.
Essentially, that was the first thing that he said after he came down the escalators. But and one of the things that made me so angry back then in 2011 is President Obama had to put forth his long-form birth certificate. And what other president has ever had to do that before? And that is something that Donald Trump tapped into, and he saw, and he knew that there was a part of America that was really angry about having a black president. And that's just the reality, and we need to have that real conversation about race.
Well, do you think in a sense that, I mean, you worked with a whole lot of Democrats,
yeah.
You worked for David Axelrod.
Yeah.
Do you think it was too soon? Do you think Obama was pushed as a candidate before that there was going to be this
reaction? Honestly, Bonnie, I don't know if there would ever have been a right time. You know, I think it was his moment. You know, I think he took his moment, and it was for people like me, for folks like me, it was an amazing time, and it was inspirational. You felt like you had a place in the world, because you had someone named Barack Hussein Obama who was running for president. And you had someone like Michelle Obama and their two children who are going to be in the White House. And I think, and each of them, Michelle and Obama, have their own really deep, wonderful history with this country. And that spoke for many of us. And I don't regret it. I don't think he shouldn't have done it. I think it was his moment and he took it. I just think that America has a big problem with race, and it's very real, and we have yet to deal with it because it's an ugly, difficult, hard discussion to have.
Elsie, and when will it end?
I've
done a lot of reading about the Civil War, and
it,
in some ways, the South really never gave up. After it lost, it may have lost the war, but it won the battle, and there have actually been books written about that, segregation, that the treatment of blacks, you think about the treatment of black Americans who had no economic power in the South or in the North, but it was better in the North than the South. They couldn't get educated, they couldn't vote, all their economic powers were restricted on purpose in the South until the 60s, 100 years, Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
And for 100 years that went on in the American South. And what you have now is it's still, I think, worse. There are more poor African Americans percentage-wise in the South than in the North. And, but what's gonna, can we ever get beyond it?
I think we have to get out there and vote. That's the power of the vote, the power of getting out there, the power of speaking up. And we saw that the last 2 years, what it meant and what it looked like when we took that to the ballot box. But I say that, and, we're talking about the 100 years Civil War, and it reminds me that there are different forms of Jim Crow happening. When you're talking about the Voting Rights Act that got gutted in 2013, and what sprouted across the country are these bills, these legislation that has made it really difficult for people of color, black people, now Native Americans, if you look at North Dakota and what happened, to go out and vote.
Or North Carolina,
exactly.
Forcing, purchasing unfilled in absentee ballots from older infirm African Americans.
And so that's the scary part, and that's what we have to fight against. It's one of those things where, yes, voting is really powerful, but will people be able to vote? Can they go out and vote? And so we're fighting different fights on so many different levels. And so voting is important, getting out there, changing the tide, changing the representation. We saw that. We saw great victories in the last 2 years. And then we have to fight these awful voter suppression law, which is racism. I mean, we got to call it what it is. And then it just continues and continues. But that's why I have hope. One of the reasons I have hope is not just that we took back the House, is that we also switched over some state chambers, which is really important. We won about 7 governorships, which is really important, we meaning Democrats. And so that is going to play into the type of legislations that we see in these states and being able to really look at 2020 and winning back the White House as well.
For 2020, do you have great hopes or are you nervous or...
I have all of it. I have hope. I'm nervous. Speaking about hope, so I started off my career in politics because I'm an immigrant. I grew up with, my parents are immigrant. I know what it's like to grow up in this country and not have much, but wanting the American dream and wanting the best for yourself. And now I have a 4-year-old. I talked to you about that earlier before we started this interview. And that matters to me. And having a young girl who I'm raising, a young girl of color, and what type of country am I gonna leave for her? And also I wonder when she gets to a place and she learns about our history and she learns about the Donald Trump administration, if she asks me, hey, what were you doing when Donald Trump was, doing all these horrible things as president in the White House, I want to be able to say to her that I fought, that I did everything that I can to fight, that I worked for Move On and all the great things that we were able to do and what we were able to do as a country to fight back against the oppression, right? The movement, the progressive movement. And so that's why I have hope, is because of her. And I have to. Or else it's going to be hard to do this work if you don't have any hope.
So you say registering to vote, pressing for it, H.R. 1. The very first bill in the House is all about undoing voter suppression.
Exactly, going after voting rights,
And that is what you say is the way to equality?
Yeah, I think it's really, I mean, that's one of our fundamental rights, right, is to be able to vote. And if you take that away from people, then that is taking away equality. That is taking away people's voices. And so there's a reason, as you mentioned, why the House Democrats decided that's going to be the first piece of legislation. We have to deal with that because it is racism to suppress people's vote, especially when you're looking at people of color in particular and you're making sure that they're not going to vote or they cannot vote or their vote is stolen. So yes, that's one of the most important things to do, is to go out and vote and make sure that we register people to vote. And that's going to be key in 2020.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you,
Bonnie. It's been such an honor.
Oh.
Really appreciate your time.
And I appreciate it.
Best of luck to you and all your work.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
That's it for this edition of To the Contrary. Please follow me on Twitter and visit our website, pbs.org/To the Contrary. And whether you agree or think to the contrary, see you next week.